Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Moraine Python Radio. And tonight we have Buddy Buscemi, who was our first Green Tree Python guest 12 years ago.
Owen. Like, my God.
He was the first one. I remember he contacted me and he was, really, really keen in what we were doing. And obviously he was more of a chondro guy and we were more carpet guys. And, it was, he was happy to come on and help us get other guests. And, and then after a couple of years, I guess, then GTP Keeper Radio kicked out.
Yep.
And then those guys were off on their own.
Yeah. We kicked those baby birds off out of the nest and, you know, they went and flew. It's funny when we talk about Buddy, and it's like one of those things where it's, We both went and got Green Tree Pythons and stuff from him. And yes. I'm like, I immediately realized I was way over my skis with this. And I'm just like, take this back. And he's like, here are rhino rat snakes. I'm like, thank you. And then I ran off and did that. So he's like, yeah, okay, here. So it was good to have that trade back. So, but
we'll talk about
because we're so far into the rhinos now here. And I'm like, those my original trio was.
So your original trio came from Buddy?
My original trio came from Buddy.
Okay.
And I still have a pair of the original trio. I lost one, unfortunately, but every single rhino I have produced can be linked back to Buddy. Like, you know, yeah.
Nice. So, yeah. There you go. Cool. All right. Before we got Buddy on, Tim Morris wrote to us. And I thought I waited until this episode to sort of to talk about his message. Mm-hmm. Two reasons. One, because Buddy and Tim are I think Tim was Buddy's mentor.
They know each other. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll read it and then we'll bring Buddy on and we'll go. So it says, hey, guys, really enjoyed the IJ roundtable. IJ. Wink, wink. He put that in there as a little, he says it would have been more enjoyable if it were a video podcast. Well, it's funny you say that. We were just talking about that video podcast is over on our Patreon.
Right.
But everything else is just audio, but you know, I can't let comments about the chondro lineages go. Right. So,
Nope.
I can't remember exactly what Nick said, but it was sort of like not having pictures. And, I guess it was kind of a mild shot at the chondro guys from
as Nick is
from Mr. Mutton
to do. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think he really he doesn't get along with that community too well.
But, you know, I step away and let you do one show without me. And
I know. And everything falls apart.
We get letters. So, we've never gotten letters or none that you let me see. But yeah,
so he understands the point regarding the fact that they are mutt lineages, which I don't know. I don't necessarily care about that. But Nick was kind of like, oh, yeah, they were breeding this and that, blah, 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 blah. But however, in fairness, these lineages did originate with animals acquired in the 70s, which is freaking wild, man. it's almost as old as me.
And also it's like they're mutt lineages. Like, well, at the point that they were like. Is it one of those things where they became mutts because the taxonomy changed?
Yes. So that's sort of why.
Blame anybody for that?
That's sort of why I was talking to that with David Brahms. We were talking about. But anyway, it says, however, fairness, these lineages did originate from animals that were acquired back in the 70s, and locality data was rarely, if ever, available, which is interesting. Some of the accession codes. I hope I'm saying that right. Accession codes. Well, I think it has something to do with the zoo because it's codes that were actually correspond with zoo stud books.
Well, that's why we do 1.1 point. That's why we have those point system that's direct from zoo stock.
Right.
Stuff.
Right. Yeah. So additionally, up to until about 10 to 15 years ago, exact characteristics of various localities were not known for certain conjurers. Okay. I think he says, except perhaps the Australians, the Aroos, and the Biaks, right? Yeah, I would probably agree with that.
Further,
with advance in GPS technology, it's now possible to get better locality information. However, except for the farms, and even then, 15 to 20 years ago, certainly with respect to establishing the population of origin was someone's word, typically Cameron's, which, I mean, that's sort of how the locality thing goes, regardless of what species you're working with. In my opinion, it always goes back to a person. You have to trust that person if they're right, unless you're the one that collected it.
I think
that debate has been done to death, you know, so
it has I agree with him. You know.
Yeah. No. Anyway, I thought adding some perspective to the origin of the chondro lineages and the challenges of attempting to confirm the origins of an unknown individual dictated the limitations in the type of information that you could reliably include. So,
okay.
Basically, the information that they had is what they did. That's what they shared with. You couldn't really get the information a lot of times with GPS and all that kind of stuff. Now,
it sounds like they did the best they could at the time.
Yes.
I don't understand what the problem is. Like,
with that,
let's bring Buddy on. Yeah, now we're bringing Buddy on. Buddy, why didn't you do everything? Why weren't there GPS tags and full res photographs of every green tree python?
What gives?
Yeah.
I don't know. We are some hackers in the Green Tree Python community.
Someone
you're too ready on trying to figure out how to keep them alive and breed them, right?
Yeah, weird.
Tim hit it right on. There's a lot of, Trooper caught it. Before we talk about the mud thing, I mean, that's a Trooper has called them for years. So that's kind of been a slang term that he's his basement mutts that he. But, you know, you have to remember, like in 1977, take a photograph, take it to a film processor, have the film process, and then how would you attach a photo to a lineage? I mean, we're so used to living in the electronic age where you just, drag it from one file and drop it into whatever format you're creating your lineage with, it's there. I mean, that just didn't exist back then.
That's a good point.
Just with what they could. I would just say there's very few privately bred species like green tree pythons that have the lineage that goes back to 1977. I mean, other than zoo lineages, I would love to see if someone has done a better job of keeping lineage records than the Green Tree Python folks. And it's a testament to, how serious they were and the time they dedicated to these species to make sure that, some of these folks no longer are with us anymore, but we still have the records and can still look back to certain animals and see certain animals. Lineage in the history. I think it's pretty neat myself. I have some animals that go way back to the 70s, and it's, for me, it's just, you'll look back and you say, oh, that breeder, produced this clutch. Well, they're no longer in the hobby. This breeder, breeder produced this clutch and they're no longer in the hobby. So what these lineages have done, it's taken the possibility of error in understanding what the true lineage is from basically word of mouth and hearsay to actually, to documents written down on paper that have been handed down from, breeder to breeder. And it's still passed forward today.
Yeah, I agree that I think, in my opinion, I borrowed, stole, whatever you want to say, a couple ideas from the chondro community. One would be lineages. I think, exposed to you guys back at the first Carpet Fest, I think there was more chondro people there than there were.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
I remember, right?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. And I just remember how you, I was impressed that you guys, you know, did that from the get go, you know, and I don't know. It just always stuck with me and how cool it is to just see that history. And to your point, when people are gone, those animals still, you know, still carry on in that, I guess if you want to call it your life's work or however you want to look at it, still sort of carries on. So, yeah. We also borrowed Carpet Fest or Conjure
Fest.
Yeah,
we stole it. That. We took that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah.
I mean, you have taken it to a level that, we've never been able to achieve with the Condor Fest. So you guys have refined it and done a way better job of doing it on an annual basis and getting different regions involved with different Carpet Fests. I mean, that's pretty amazing that the impact that that has had on the community.
We're getting copied now because now there's a Croc Fest, a Turtle Fest. I hear there's a Colubrid Fest that's coming out now. So it's like, we stole it from you. Now people are stealing it from us. Like
the student
like,
has become the master.
Yeah, I don't know. What's going, yeah, I know how you guys felt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Think about all the good things that come from those events, though. You have people that you know are communicating. Through what we, I guess, consider the new reality of electronic media like we're doing right now, that it's much different to see people in person and talk to them and shake their hand or, you know, eat, share a meal with them. And just regardless of what their passion is or what species they're keeping, when you meet them and talk to them, it's pretty amazing. I think one of my favorite experiences was when Benson Morrell was at one of the Carpet Fests. And I think maybe Nick was there. I can't remember. But this young person, like maybe 10, 11 or 12, he walked up to Nick and was like, "Hey, can I have you, can you sign this book?" And then Nick was like, "Well, also you want to get, this person over here to sign this book because he wrote this section." So his eyes were like huge. Like, you got to be kidding me. They're both here. So the positive impact that has on the community, that one day, of goodwill usually carries everyone through to the next year. And it's a good thing. I'm glad I was able to attend when I could.
Yeah. I think anything that can bring people together in today's day and age is a good thing. If there's something that people can unite on as a group, even though they may have, the disagreements in other areas, that, that was, to me, was always the amazing thing, is like you have people from so many different backgrounds and so many different ways of looking at the world. But yet somehow we're all here and Eric's not such a bad guy. Owen, he's okay.
He's a bad guy.
It's amazing, man. And I wonder, if we'll even be able to understand the impact that, the thing you're talking about with Nick and Ben, like that kid, I'm sure, as this, hopefully if it keeps progressing, maybe one day that'll be a story that he tells, like, so how'd you get into reptiles? Well, I was at this Carpet Fest, that kind of thing. It's cool. That's cool.
Very, very cool. You guys should be proud of doing that. That's a good thing for everyone.
Yeah.
So the very first Carpet Fest was my first chondro I ever got, and it was from Buddy. And man, I was so torn with looking back now, I don't know. I wish I would have kept that snake. It was a solid yellow, except for like maybe five green scales, Biak. That was Chiquita that I traded for Molly Ringwald.
For a while, when you called me, that was the picture that came up, is you looking down at this like gorgeous chondro in a bin going like
in the thing.
Like, yeah, should I buy this? Like, it was just like straight down. It was that look on your face. So that was replaced by you in the Pope regalia. So
Oh, that's how I am now.
Oh yeah, that's the dip. That's what changed. Yep.
So what have you been up to, buddy? I mean, we haven't seen each other since we were talking about it since 2019
Carpet Fest.
Carpet Fest. Yeah. So what have you been up to?
I can't believe it's been 5 years. Nothing new too much in the snake world. Still have a sizable green tree python collection. Still, my snakes are still in the same corner of the basement that they were when you guys came and visited me many years ago. Nothing too much has changed too drastically. That's pretty much it. Doing green tree python stuff. I guess maybe the most interesting thing since we've talked is I hatched out a snake during the pandemic, actually. It looked really interesting and I wasn't sure really what it was. And so I reached out to a few people, including Nick. I thought Nick would be a good person because Nick's impartial. He's not involved with the green tree python community. So I thought Nick would give me his most honest,
straight answer. Yeah.
What he thinks this thing is before I start thinking about what it was. Anyway, we've seen this thing. It may have been a hypomelanistic chondro.
Whoa.
Okay. So yeah, pretty interesting. So that animal, I kept a sizable amount of the clutch mates from that animal back, and those animals are going into our breeding age. So next year will be the first. I'm going to do a sid to sid pairing. Mm-hmm. And so the animal that looked hypomelanistic, it died at about 2 years of age. It just stopped eating. And you guys know how I feel about animals that, it'll coddle stuff. If they're going to eat, they're going to eat. If they're going to stop, they're going to stop. If they can't figure it out, so be it. Developing something which could be considered a morph, like you want the strongest animals possible. I've been trying to work on that a little bit to see if that definitely is the case. Is it a hypomelanistic gene? And is it inheritable? So I've been focused on that. Bill decided that my life wasn't exciting enough and that he would send me a sickness offspring.
I love how he just decided that.
So he sent that out. So that animal's here. He's been fun though. He's a gorgeous snake. I can't help but stare at him every day. Bill and I did joint pairing, but other than that, just doing green tree python stuff. Yeah.
The top left.
Was that the?
No. Bottom
right.
Bottom right.
Yep. Okay.
So bottom right is the sickness kid.
Yeah. And that's nice. Neisseria.
Nice.
Okay.
The parents of the hypomelanistic one, or were they just normal green trees and just this popped out, or was this one of your, blue projects? Where did they come? Where did it pop up from?
Strangely enough, all the animals involved in that breeding project are locality types. So Japura, a northern animal from Vita Cernak, his name was Nizik. And so on one side you had this male animal Nizik, who was a mainland type brought in from Czechoslovakia. I had a Japura animal that was produced by Speedy Gonzalez, and so I paired those two animals together. And then several years later I repaired that same Japura female with a Bushmaster New Blue and that Japura. Offspring from both of those clutches and paired them together. So from the Japura Music clutch, which is a 2011 clutch for me, and then the male from the Bushmaster New Blue clutch, which I think was either 2012 or 2013. It was hatching right about the first week after the first Carpet Fest you guys did. So what was that, 2012?
Somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Same female on both sides. The same job for most people call that a locality pairing because the Bushmaster New Blue is our back in Japura locality. At least that's what the Bushmaster Farm claimed. So.
Okay.
So I have two questions. One, what does a hypomelanistic chondro look like? Or, you know, what made you think it was hypomelanistic?
Well, when the first I was surprised, well, it pipped on its own, and it looked like pinkish orange color.
Okay.
And the dorsal patterns were like a faded yellow color. Okay. And initially, it's maybe just pipped a little too soon. It hasn't completely developed its colors in the egg, which sometimes can happen with an animal. But it hatched out, and it was one of the first things to feed. So I sent it to some people. Some people said looks like an albino. I didn't think it was because it didn't have like the red iris of the eye, and the tongue didn't kind of match up. The tongue was like a grayish type color. And so that's why I thought the best thing would be to send it to Nick and get his. And he kind of thought, you know, possibly hypomelanistic. And so I had a couple other animals from that clutch that looked similar, and I kept, like I said, I kept those back. And then I did a repeat pairing a couple years later. So in 23, I did a repeat pairing. Sorry, let me get my dates straight here. 21 and 22, I did a repeat pairing. And so no animals hatched that looked like that animal did. There was one that looked kind of similar to it. But a lot of those animals actually had high melanism as adults. So it's interesting. So I'm curious to see what happens. I'm going to try SID pairing this fall with a male that has a, it looks like a, I probably should have prepared better guys and sent you photographs. They look like green tree pythons, except the adult pattern is kind of faded. And the one animal has dark on it, but when you look at it really close to it, it's a dark brown, kind of like a chocolate color. That's been kind of a little bit of a focus of mine. It's up and, you know, it doesn't drive me to do anything that I'm doing, but I'm curious to see what might happen if I do a SID to SID pairing.
Sure. That's, you know, that was going to be my next question. It's so you don't really see, other than the albino, you don't really see like I don't know if you want to consider like high blue and high melanistic and, you know, high yellow. I sort of look at that as more of a polygenic trait, or perhaps maybe it's because you're crossing subspecies and you get some, or species and you get some wacky things that sometimes happens with carpets too. But you don't see like a hypo, well, maybe we will, but like, you know what I mean? Like those kind of animals.
Genetic mutation.
Is that, am I right there or am I wrong? Am I off base?
So Bill and I did a show and we talked about chondromorphs. There are some people in the chondro community that believe that the lemon trees are hypomelanistic. Yellows are actually hypomelanistic. There's a great example of, I can't remember who owns the animal, but it was a red neonate as a baby, but it turned yellow, but it has this really faded neonate pattern on it. Looks really good. And when you look at that, you say maybe hypomelanistic. So the lemon trees, from my experience, I can tell you the one that I had here had, let me take a step back maybe and talk about how I came up, how I, you know, this wasn't my original thought. Chiquita, the female that produced Chiquita, Eric, the snake that you had picked up at Carpet Fest, she was a farm-bred Biak type that I picked up from Harlan Wall.
Okay. And
so after, I posted her, she had produced a couple clutches from me, and I had posted a photo of her. And actually a breeder from Germany got a hold of me and said, hey, just out of curiosity, what's the color of the tongue of that snake? I said, gray. He's like, what are your thoughts on it being hypomelanistic? I said, I never really thought about it. And he laid out his thoughts about how he thinks certain high yellows could be hypomelanistic. And that's, you know, we just happen to call them, instead of hypomelanistic, we call them high yellow.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So, you know, we do know that that female did produce two high yellow animals, right? You got one, you had one, Eric, and I had the male. So we do know, and that was a Biak to Biak locality pairing. So no outside influences on any other designer project. Both those animals came from Harlan Wall, then they came from Bushmaster. So we know where these animals came from. So I started reaching out to folks that had just high yellow animals. I said, hey, out of curiosity, you know, what color is the tongue? What do you see? And so, you know, it's a possibility that high yellow chondros could be hypomelanistic chondros. I can't say for certain that it is, but it's a possibility. And really, if it is, it already is a morph because we're just calling it high yellow, right?
A lot of
the melanistic snakes, the blue snakes. I mean, it depends on how you want to define morph, right?
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that goes a lot into it. And you got to think that a certain, like for instance, the blue line animals, when Tim produced his animal back in 96, what was available morph wise in the general python market at that time were albinos and then ball pythons. So there really wasn't like a lot of morph stuff to be called like a morph.
Right. So
maybe if a blue python were developed today, we may consider that a morph. Just using that terminology along the same lines, it's a different look to that animal. But Bill and I did a show on that, and I think there probably could be morphs in green tree pythons. I just think we call them certain things. That's Chiquita.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's kind of, I kind of thought that way. I guess it goes back to, I just think about because you can't, it's kind of like short tail pythons, right? When you breed them together, you don't know what you're kind of going to get. Right. But like, so I always looked at it as more of a, I guess a line bred type of deal, but yeah, I get what you're saying, which is kind of cool, I guess, I don't know if having morphs in a particular species is good or bad anymore.
Depends on what you like to do with your animals and what makes you happy, what brings you joy, right?
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
So Tim and I were actually, Tim Morris and I were actually together a couple weekends ago. We've ended a show together. So it's five of us, and 30 years ago, we would have been shows together. So Tim got the ball rolling last year and said, we're going to vend one show together just to get our old crotchety butts out to a show and see what's going on. So we all went, and we did it again this year. It was a good time. But Tim and I were reminiscing. Tim took me up to Pete Call's place many years ago. Pete was focused, on the albino Bell project at the time, but he had this back bedroom that was full of ball pythons, and he was, ball pythons, and he was showing me the marker, and I was like looking at it, thinking he would show me a snake that had like two white scales randomly on its body. He's like, "Oh, that's the marker," and nothing huge, but he had, he was going through a large quantities, I guess, of imports at the time and inspecting these animals and looking for these marketers and bringing them back to develop these morphs. So if you think about how the piebald morph, I mean, now you have animals that are, everything on them is, that mostly a piebald animal, very little true wild pattern on it. And so you think about how that morph developed. I mean, it's possible in the green tree python that we're developing morphs now that they take a little longer to develop and show themselves.
You got to cross the right animal to the right animal, and then all of a sudden,
there it is. I guess it's not fair. When you're comparing a lot of species of pythons to the ball python world, retic world, thing with high morphs in it, where there's tons of breed. So with the retics, right, you have huge clutches. With the ball pythons, you have huge amount of people that are mixing wild caught animals together to, look, this has this spot or dot or stripe or pattern is weird or whatever. It just looks weird, and you're putting them together. I often think about that with carpets. Owen made fun of me for years saying dinker projects and stuff.
I do, and still do.
You never know. You look at something and it seems kind of weird. We were just talking to Darren Whitaker last week, and he had this crazy brettle that popped out that's basically like a sherbet orange with yellow, which is just like, is this something? Is this nothing? Like, who knows? But it's cool. So he's going to ride it out and see what happens. And I don't know. So yeah, maybe there are morphs already in the chondro. I just remember, and maybe I was just around the wrong people, but I remember back in the early days when I was just getting into Morelia, it was sort of like, if there were morphs in those things. Carpets or chondros were sort of like, we don't have morphs. We selectively breed them and blah, blah, blah. You know?
Yeah.
Again, it could be the people that I was with.
Yeah. The people that brought you in. Yeah.
Yeah. Negative implications with morphs and all that. Depends, like I said, it depends on how you feel about those things. There are people out there that live for morph projects. And there are people who want the wild types.
Yeah. Right?
I think
one's better than the other for sure.
Yeah, I think that morph breeders, at least I can speak for myself, when I was heavy into morphs, was more of a mad scientist type of thing. Like, what's going to pop out? It's kind of exciting when you don't know, you know, how it's going to look. And then you hatch it out and it's like, wow, that's different. And then, you know, the whole anticipation of growing it up and seeing, you know, how it turns out. As I have Owen yelling at me, wait till it sheds.
You know, and
you're
and
right.
I thank you. I know I'm right, but I feel like I've adopted this. Let's see how it develops from Green Tree breeders, because they're like, that is a gorgeous animal. Let's see how it develops as it goes. Like, you know, let's not rush into picking our holdbacks. Okay. Let's give them a minute, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
The condors too. Every time I do a different pairing, you know, I'm never in a rush to release any babies because I want to see, you know, what's going on with them and where they're headed. Of course, I don't always make the best decisions. I think they're headed one way and I keep them and they, you know, they turn out to be good looking animals. And then I've had animals I thought were okay, going to be, you know, okay looking babies, and then send them to people and they send me a picture a year later and I'm, you know, crying in the corner.
Yeah. See, yeah. No, No.
Yeah. I think as a breeder, you will eventually get there.
Yeah. Everybody has that one that you sent out to somebody, and then you're like, God damn it. I wish I had that thing back. Like, yeah.
I do like Bill's glass half full type of idea when it comes to that, right? He's always been in the mindset that it's free advertising. Because that person that has your animal is always going to us, you know, oh, look at this animal I got from Buddy, blah, blah, blah. And then it's sort of like, oh, I guess Buddy makes killer animals type of, you know what I mean? So, that's a good way to look at it.
Do you think it's a fair trade that if they get a really stellar animal from you and it turns out to be great, that you message them every once in a while and be like, will you post a damn picture or something? Like, will you like sing my praises, damn you? Like, yeah.
I need the bump here.
Yeah, bump it up. Like, do something. Yeah.
So since the last time we talked to you, how has your, if at all, how has your chondro keeping evolved? Has anything changed? Have you updated anything?
No, I don't think much has changed. I think, well, the only thing I don't know if it's a big deal or not, but I know my rodent breeder that I've been using for a long time, he hasn't been able to keep up with the large jumbo mice that I like to use. So they've been coming and they're not that double size. So I've had to start supplementing some of my females with occasional rats.
Okay.
So that's probably a different change since I've talked to you guys last. I am finally about to be retiring some like 14-year-old Grim Sharpform PVC cages. I'm going to be moving my adults into large Cambro rack systems.
Nice.
That's a change. It's going to be occurring shortly. And hopefully the animals I move make a good, adjustment. And then my plan is to essentially get rid of all my PVC style cages to take care, you know, and have the Cambros, take their place. My thing with the PVC cages, I love them. You know, I think they do a great job of holding the, you know, good temperature and humidity if you need it. But they, for me, I have a hard time sealing them with something I feel is non-toxic and isn't going to harm the animal. So
right.
I mean, the constant flux of resealing cages, and every spring and fall, I break down the stacks. I take them outside and I scrub the outside of the cages where they've leaked. And, you know, I decided last fall that I'm just about done carrying snake enclosures outside to scrub them. every 6 months or
yeah.
So, those are some changes, but with incubation, I out of it there. So that's,
those are the bins that you had, you had your rhinos in those kind of,
yeah, the Tannenbar in them too, right?
Thank you. The Tannenbar is right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So these tubs are tall.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And so this is a product from Focus Cubed out of Texas.
Okay.
I like that.
Just sing their praises a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They make a product that's similar to this, except it pulls out on the short side.
Okay.
Okay.
And I think they use FlexWatt for heating. And you guys know, you've been where I keep my snakes. It's like ambient temperatures, like 70,
right,
like that. So it's not very warm there. And I try not to use a lot of FlexWatt because it can struggle to maintain even the lower temps I keep my chondros at. So
yeah,
I reached out to him and said, would you ever consider designing a snake rack that looks like the picture everyone's looking at here, which is a three pump stack. These are the large Cambro polycarbonate food boxes. And could you incorporate heat panels into it? Center mounted heat panels. And Steve said, well, let me think about it. And some time went by and he got back to me with a CAD drawing. He's like, is this what you think you would want? I was like, absolutely. And so he built the prototype, sent me photos of it, ran the prototype. And the problem was for him as well was he wasn't getting the ambience that I get normally. So he wanted to make sure there would be no problem with the radiant heat panels.
Right.
When they're on the bottom, overheating the enclosure on top. Now, my plan is to run each heat panel is going to be controlled by its own thermostat. So that's a fit for me, right? I wouldn't do one thermostat probe in this rack with the heat panels. But when the temperatures reached the ambience, he tested them. You probably can't tell from here, but he actually, so the spacing that's underneath the cage, the one that has polycarb tub in it, there's actually a heat shield over top of the heat panel.
So the bottom panel, the panel on the bottom isn't going to affect
the next guy up. Photo with you. So there's the heat panel. So off to the left there, that's a high density plastic extrusion slider. So the tub slides out on that. And then where you're pointing to now, that's a shield over top of the heat panel below it. And then to the left of that, there's a white rectangular piece of PVC with four screws in it.
Yeah.
That the temperature probe goes. So the temperature probe gets locked in. And he actually, if you look at the heat panel to the left of the heat panel,
there's clips.
There is a similar size area that's machined out. So when you slide the tub out, the probe, if it's the right length, slides right up in there and doesn't impact the tub sliding in or out.
Wow.
Put a lot of great thought in. He thought of things that I never would have thought of.
Yeah.
And so he finally said, okay, I'm going to make them. And so I ordered two sets and they came in last Friday. We started this company last September.
That's cool.
So I'm, going to have purchase from David Brahms in them that are made for these tubs. And so they're going to be a nice setup. I'm hoping they work really well because, like I said, eventually I'd like to get rid of all the PVC cages. Yep, those are the perches. And so they're offset perches. The one in the back is, up a couple inches taller. So that'll be the warmer perch. And I run my warm spot store today between 82 and 84. So I've got them tweaking it right now. Also, it won't be directly on the floor in my basement. I'm going to have it up about 8 inches off the ground with a little bit of insulation underneath of it. That way the bottom tub doesn't lose too much heat. But that's the plan. So hopefully they work out well because I like to eventually replace all those PVC cages and move my animals into those.
I love that. I love the purchase with the twist.
Yeah. And that's a dye product. So that's not a, that's dyed.
Okay.
So that was one of my questions. Was that, what is it? And he's like, it's a dye. It's a non-toxic dye type substance that they use. But Stephen was great to work with. He did. I mean, he took what I wanted and he made it even better. Like I would never have thought of additional tuning factors. And you know,
yeah, you can really see the layout of that in this shot. If you look, you know, in that shot there with the rectangular heat probe thing and the radiant heat, that's genius. Wow.
Yeah. That's cool. I like.
Yeah. And you know, someone owns a company. I'm sure he's a busy, very busy person. He could probably not have to worry about, you know, fulfilling a special request for some guy that may wind up ordering maybe a total of six of these, but he did. And yeah. I think he said he's going to make them available. I think he's calling the Concept 3 Max.
Okay.
I'm not sure if they're up yet, but he does plan to make them available. So they're very, very good.
That's cool.
And you had, yeah, here's a different shot looking at it close.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you can see where the probe would go.
Oh, you can see the gap and all that. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
I love that. Really, that's cool. Great. Yeah. That's
really cool, man. All right. That's exciting, man. So what is it about I was just want to circle back real quick. You were saying about toxic stuff with PVC. I've heard this a couple times. What's going on there? Is it the PVC itself?
Well, they don't let you. Well, PVC, the polyvinyl carbon, whatever, decarbonate, whatever it is.
Yeah.
The pipes themselves are fine. However, they mm-hmm. do gas. I actually made some scorch purchase years and years ago with PVC, and I actually one day I was kind of bored at work and I made them at work. I was outside of work, scorched these things. You know, I scrubbed them when they were done with baking soda, but I put them in my car and I noticed, you know, during the summer months, I noticed when I got in my car smelled chemically, like it was off gas. And so you guys know, I work in the fire department. One of the things I did in the fire department was hazardous material handling. So we had very fancy meters. So I took the meter and put it on there, and it was off gas. And I can't remember if it was hydrogen cyanide. I can't remember what it was exactly.
Oh, something bad. Okay. Yeah.
So I was like, well, these are going right in the dumpster. So I think as long as you don't heat them up, they're okay. That's my impression.
So, okay. I got you. I
think the way David twists them, I don't think he heats them to that point where when you burn them, they're going to off gas longer. So when they have a brown look to them. So.
Gotcha. Okay. Wow. And then you were saying the other thing before we got into the cages, you were saying something about incubation with green trees that has changed.
I used to incubate 87.8. And then a couple years ago, maybe, can't remember. Like I said, I was telling Eric before the show, when I think 2 years ago, for some reason, I go back to 2018. Harlan and I had a discussion a few years ago about, you know, how he was using like an 86.5 and others were using it. And they just thought that their babies were larger, more robust. And I started doing it and I haven't seen any negative impact. I don't know if I necessarily see the babies are bigger or not, but I don't weigh my babies. So I can't say just by looking at them that that's the case or not. But so, you know, that's it really. Same old, better than for the past forever. Still using the same 25-year-old Herbstep Basic to run my.
Yep, till it dies. Yes.
Don't change it.
Don't touch the incubator until something goes wrong. Till then, keep going. Okay. Yep.
Where's your? Is there as far as chondros go? Are you happy with what you have? Are there things you want to add? Are you leery of doing that? Like, what's your feeling there?
I actually haven't purchased a condor since like 2014.
Okay.
So, I love chondros, right? You guys know that. You've been around.
Yeah. We gained that. Yeah, we figured that out.
But there are people that are doing amazing things with them. But one of my goals has always been for my own collection was to have the majority, if not all the animals in my collection, be produced by me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
One way you really know you can control the quality of your animals. You know their complete history. And now I have animals that are, F2s and F3s in my collection. So I understand, the lineages and, I've had the animals in my collection. There's some animals that look nice. I always love locality animals. I would say if you had to say, who would you buy a chondro from? John Leckie makes amazing chondros, and John Leckie
heard that. Yeah,
he has a female from that same clutch that Chiquita was from, and he's been pairing her with some animals, and they've made some stellar high yellow animals. I would love to maybe get an animal from one of those pairings, bring to my collection. So for the most part, I just enjoy looking at everybody else's animals, and enjoy having what I have. I don't foresee my collection getting much bigger, I guess I'm at stasis with chondros.
I want to be.
I can continue doing what I'm doing. I may bring in some new blood. I still love Beaks. Like, they're my favorite locality of all time. Mm-hmm. I know Patrick Holmes has produced a couple of pure Beak clutches. I'll bring in some animals from that, those type of things, which I may have to do eventually, depending on how much further I'm going to go with this, breeding snakes in the future, right? I had my first clutch way back in 91, and God, I was 23, right? Here I am, 50, I'm 56 now. So 3 years later, still doing it, right? Mm-hmm. So I got to figure out how much longer am I going to really do this, and at what level and what intensity and those type of things. So
you could always just keep doing it until I found that if eventually you come to the crossroads where will you become Craig Trumbauer or not? Like, will you just become the long bearded snake guy, all the way up into that, or will you just not? So that's, you have to hit that crossroads,
Yeah. I've always been in the snakes, and one of the first people, my wife's friends, one of the first things I'll ask my wife is, why do you let all those snakes in your house? And she kind of says, it was a package deal. Like, I knew he was doing it. This wasn't years after we got married, I got into this. Like, I had snakes when we were dating, and I had snakes when we were engaged, and
sure.
So it's part of who I am. I don't forever see a time in my period, a time in my life where I won't have snakes in some capacity in my life. But, number? There's some other things. There's some other snake things I want to do. But I still, look at animals and think, wow, that would be a fun thing to kind of figure out and try to work with a little bit. So I still want to try to do those things as well.
What would that species be?
Yeah, which one's that?
Well, you guys know I like green snakes.
Okay. Yeah. Anaconda, right? No. You're just going to flood your basement? Anaconda. I took a shot, I figured.
You said green.
Well, the exact opposite of a green tree python, giant-ass anaconda,
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Be fine.
Size is require tremendous...
Yep. Yeah.
I like the Arizona green rat snakes.
Very cool. Yeah, very cool.
Of course, I've been down that colubrid path before, right? With rhinos. Yep. And but yeah, I'd like to try those.
What was that other species that you had at the time? You had rhinos and then you had something else.
Those were the Prasina. There was the green bush.
That's snake. It.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. They're still around. I have strangely enough, one of the guys that I used to vend shows with, decades ago, He lives like 7 or 8 miles from me. He was also big in the Condors at one point, but he strictly does Asian colubrids now.
Nice.
And so, I can't, we were talking one day and I was like, you know, I have these snakes, you know, they're interesting. And he's like, oh, if you don't want them, I'll take them from you. So I took the, cause remember I had a clutch hatch.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the female laid eggs in my, you know, here, and the babies hatched and I established them. So I took them all over to him. They're still over there. They're still around.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah. That's cool.
The male, the adult male actually escaped. And my youngest, my oldest son, Victor, was helping me clean snake cages. And, you know, those guys were fast and biting.
Yeah.
And he decided he was going to, you know, so he slid the tub out and the snake shot out. And he's like, Dad, the snake's got out. So by the time I had turned around, we couldn't find it.
Oh, you know, geez.
The whole place apart. We couldn't find it. And literally like 6 weeks later, my oldest son, Victor, was drinking a glass of water by the kitchen sink. And right outside the kitchen sink, we have a giant maple tree. And he's like, Dad, snake crawling down the maple tree. And I was like, that's the snake that escaped from it.
I held it, get up in a tree. Yeah, whatever.
We only can envision, we have a, you know, you guys know we have an area where the dogs can get out in and out of the basement with. We think he got out.
Sure.
Out through that way. But yeah, you know, we took them over to our friend's house. But yeah, they were green. They're beautiful snakes.
Yeah. I have a rhino female, an adult female, that she came to me without a horn, that she must have rubbed it off or done something. And every time I look at her, she reminds me of those snakes that you had, because they were very much like a rhino without a horn. And it was, yeah. So,
yeah. I think my experience with the rhinos weren't as bitey.
Yeah. I mean, I have some feisty babies right now.
Yeah, Owen was saying about how bitey they are.
I thought they were right now. I don't know.
Chill.
It might just be.
Do you have anything that's not a feisty killer?
Just be me. So, but
yeah, these are good feeders, though, right?
Oh yeah, exactly. I don't care. Be piranhas. Just don't bite me all you want. Just don't hurt each other. So you know, I. Because I still have a female and a male from the rhinos I got from you. Mm-hmm. They are split up right now because I have other rhinos and we're trying to expand out. But that was, I'm so glad I gave you that green tree python back. Like, it was just, please take this. I can't handle it. Oh, thank you. Yeah. So,
yeah. Me and Owen have not had a good with groomers, but I'm going to try to make up for it later on once I get my room dialed back in. I like the locality stuff. I think herping affected me that way, and probably maybe being older. I don't like the rat race of the morph thing. I just don't like it anymore. Snakes are beautiful, you know, across the gamut of all stuff, of morphs and all, so, but just not my thing as far as being the world's first and no more.
Seems so. Like it's a different mindset, like the rush to produce, to prove,
yeah,
to market, to bring to market. It seems like it is, you know, a different mindset, but I'm sure there's people that enjoy it. That's maybe what brings them enjoyment in the hobby could be. I'm not sure.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I see some people and they're just fired up about, you know, like we were just talking to Darren and you know, he's got so many different projects. I don't know. How many snakes did he say he had?
He said 600. He said 600. 600 to 700 snakes. And it was like, oh, well, I hatched out a weird one. So of course I kept like, four or five of them just to be safe. And I'm like, Jesus, like you can just keep the weird one. But yeah, it was.
Yeah. Well, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
I'm back. Next thing you know, you have an army and you're wondering how you got here. Right.
Oh, yep.
Yeah.
That is 100%. And then I keep grabbing stuff and pulling it in that, you know, I'm like, yeah, I can do false water cobra. And then I have false water cobra. And it's like, okay. They're here now. So, yeah.
you know, another dynamic that works with me and Owen is the fact that he is keeping all of these species, so he has the experience to speak on it. But in order to run NPR efficiently, there has to be somebody that doesn't have as much to do.
I cannot edit podcasts. I'm too busy. I spent an hour after work cleaning a snake rack today, and I'll have to do more tomorrow in between running to FedEx and doing a bunch of other stuff. So right.
With that being said, let's talk about GTP Keeper Radio for a minute.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be interesting because I guess we're like of that era of reptile podcasting when there was maybe like what, 3 or 4 maybe, and we were 2 of them.
Yeah.
It's just a different world, you know. I don't know what tell me about it. Like, I don't know, what's GPT Keeper Radio? That's always a tongue twister for me.
Where are we? So we just had January for us is 10 years.
Okay.
Right? We certainly don't put the same effort that YouTube put into delivering your content, right? You know, a good year for us is like 4 podcasts.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys remember before I even did it, I talked to you guys about, hey, what are your thoughts about if we, you know, if I do a similar type podcast, but just focus on green tree pythons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because guys at that point have been around for a few years and, you know, a good role model and still do deliver a lot of great content to folks on every aspect of the hobbies. I mean, think about what you focused on when you first started and how you've branched out and what topics you cover. I mean, you don't really need to like Morelia pythons to enjoy the content that you guys have created and made available to everyone. It's everything, you know, anything about everything in the hobby. So it's really great material. We are definitely focused on, you know, green tree pythons is what we're focused on.
Right.
We've never done a show that didn't focus on green tree python. So when we started, the first decision for me was like, who would do the show with me?
Mm-hmm.
I'll do it solo. And I thought that at that point I was, you know, maybe 10 or 11 years deep in the keeping chondros and, you know, 7 or 8 years of producing chondros. So I thought really for the, get the best out of the show and not to be like a podcast that's just kind of geared towards expert level or very experienced level keepers. I wanted to engage everyone that was interested in green tree python. So I thought it would be best to bring somebody on that was relatively new to keeping green tree pythons and to have someone who, for instance, had experience with already keeping and breeding ball pythons or carpet mm-hmm. pythons. Mm-hmm. No, I've never kept a ball python or bred them. I can't tell you, I would be lying to you if I told you that this is how they're different and this is how they're similar. So I wanted someone to provide that information to people and maybe think about things in a different way that I don't think about them. Like maybe I don't care about what your baby rack temperature is or how do you provide hydration? But, you know, those are great questions that people are new to the species. They want to know those things. And so that was the first thing. And so I met Bill at ICAST in 2013. So that's what my mind originally went to. And then I remember asking Bill and he's like, what? You know, he was really honest. Why in the world would you want me? And so I explained to him, like, this is why, Bill. I think this is where you would fill this need that I think that I may overlook, not purposefully, but possibly accidentally. And so that was it. And so Bill and I got together when he agreed. And I said, you know, we want to demystify keeping green tree pythons. We want to, you know, do our best to talk about the myths. Let's try to debunk them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try to make the information as we didn't want it to be scientifically driven information. We wanted for the laykeeper that maybe wasn't even like, oh, green tree pythons. I've always seen those. Let's just listen to this podcast and see what it's about, right? So we wanted that type of content. We wanted to be able to provide people with access to things like, you know, what about caging ideas? Cage, you guys know caging's very expensive, right? Think about it. Even back then, when we started 10 years ago, like, you know, buy a condor for $400 and then go spend another $400 on a cage and a thermostat, right? So you're talking about a significant financial investment for people. So we wanted to just try to figure out ways to make it more economical, more approachable for people who wanted to keep green tree pythons. I still say probably the best green tree python keeper in the world hasn't realized that green tree pythons are being kept in captivity yet. And so that's why it's important to get this content out to people. You need to make sure that, you know, this doesn't die with us, right? We don't want this to go away. The great hobby. Yep. I love almost all of the aspects of it. I want people to feel like they can be inspired. And hopefully Bill and I, we can inspire people to keep them. And we try to have people with different techniques on how to keep things. Like Bill and I keep things differently. And if you do frequent any of the Facebook group, you'll see there's a lot of contention over keeping animals differently than like say I do or like Bill does. But Bill and I keep our animals differently. We don't slam each other or talk bad about each other because he does things one way and I do things the other way. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, there's no black and white. There's this huge gray area. And as long as you're within that gray area, you're going to be okay. And so show to people that there's more than one right way to keep these things and, you know, try to offer good content and make people feel confident that they could go and, you know, source a nice green tree python and confidently keep it as
Yeah, I think, now Bill's the mayor of Condro Town. So
yeah, apparently, I didn't know there was an election. Did we miss that?
So he's come a long way.
Yeah.
I think it was great that you guys did that because I don't know, to your point, right? Me and Owen, obviously Owen, he was never really a green tree guy. I don't think he's ever been, nor which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
I've had three. Like
he's just not his thing, which again, yeah. That, you know, it is what it is. It's cool. But I didn't really have the experience. I felt like I didn't ask the right questions because unless you're like keeping the animal, it's kind of like one of those things, and you can't kind of do everything type of deal. And then like when you guys came along, I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. There's so much that we're missing when it comes to this, you know, because we're not hitting on those things that, you know, even if it's a beginner keeper, maybe the beginner keeper, but maybe the intermediate keeper, but you guys filled that niche really well and did a great job. Do you have a favorite episode? I know. When people ask me this question, I don't know either what to say.
So I think that, one of my favorites. So we did a locality specific breeder one. That was pretty good just because of the content was great, but the people that we had on were just, they worked, it was three of them and they worked really well together. And I think I laughed through most of it because it was informative, but funny. That was a good one. We did one with, GTP keepers and breeders and, the UK.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. How do you guys remember that
one?
Well, you know, where are your animals coming from? How are you keeping it in that situation? Caging differences, those type of things. You know, it's not available over here. It's available over there for husbandry. And we did a all women's breeding roundtable. We had three females. We did that. That was a good show. But I think probably, I don't know if it was my favorite, but I think probably the most impactful one that we did was when we had Cody Bordolini on talking about nidovirus.
That was a big thing then, for sure.
That was the beginning of a change of a lot of things in the hobby. It was good for the content, I think. But there's been ones that, you know, we had one where we brought on an experienced breeder and a brand new keeper, and the brand new keeper got to interview the experienced keeper. That was a fun one.
I like
that. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that concept.
It's all the good. We've built, so just to update everyone in case you haven't heard or you haven't known that. So we talked a little bit about lineages and why I think it's important to have that information. Mm-hmm. That way, you know, when there's no more Buddy Buscemi around, if you have an animal and have by lineage, you kind of understand where that animal came from. And so last year Bill and I talked, like, let's try to focus on some bloodlines, historic bloodlines, and just talk about them, bring people on, try to capture, certain bloodlines, like you guys did recently with Tim, when you guys were talking about blue and those type of things. So we had started doing last year, we did a show, and then and I had talked about this on another podcast not that long ago, but my mom had a tragic accident and passed away.
Sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I mean, it's pure, a tragedy for sure. She left behind her stepdad, her husband, and he, he's not, they both weren't a picture of health to begin with. And so there was some time spent moving him from this tremendous home, and, getting him in a place where he was going to be, well taken care of. And so that I and his family could sleep better at night. So that took apart. That was the first half of the year. And then sometime in the spring, I started having some vague abdominal pain.
Mm-hmm.
It would come and go. And then I was starting to get these. So I was doing a lot of running last year. And the longer run I did, the longer it takes for the pain to go away. So finally went and saw my doc, and they ordered some tests. And so I had they discovered a mass in my abdomen in early summer last year. And, so of course you have a mass in your abdomen, never a good thing. Right. And I joked with Bill about it. I was like, I knew it was serious because the secretary didn't call to tell me the results. The doctor actually called.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Because, that's the start of a serious conversation. So, which resulted in more tests and, more diagnostic stuff and, some people thought it was benign. Some people thought it possibly could be cancerous based on where it was in my body. And then the hard part was trying to find somebody that could actually do the surgery so we could get in there. They couldn't biopsy it because of where it was. So I couldn't go in and have a biopsy done. Okay. So we were kind of relying on the MRI imaging and some other stuff to kind of tell us, like, this is what it looks like. This is what we think is in it, which at this point was still kind of, good news.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can imagine, my life is now focused on what's going on with me. So royal priority. And on top of that, I'm also preparing to move my 18-year-old son to where Bill lives to go to college. So
you don't have an 18-year-old kid. Your kids are not that old. Like that's stop it.
Ellen, you look like my oldest son with your beard now. So just
let's say I think I saw a picture of you with your boys and they're both taller than you now. It's like, oh good, okay.
I kind of confided in Bill and said, hey, look, this is what's going on. And so I don't, the show is not really a priority at this point.
If
it goes on, I'm going to have to really rethink everything show wise and possibly even my, my laptop collection. Right?
Yeah.
So I found a surgeon and they sent me to a surgeon who was a surgical oncologist. He's a wonderful surgeon. And, he was very upbeat and very, optimistic. He's like, I think that this is not cancerous. I think that I can do this laparoscopically. So I think, we're going to schedule surgery. It's going to be a 30-minute to an hour surgery. We're going to get whatever this is out. And then 2 weeks, you'll be back to normal.
Okay.
So I go for the surgery. And so the other reason I picked the surgeon too, because I went to other surgeons and they were like, well, if we get in there and we look at it and we can't go laparoscopically, we'll have to come back out. And then we need to find somebody else to do this. So this guy was able to do it all. So this one, besides he was, you know, you meet the right person, you just know that this is the person I want to miss. Yeah. So we went, so in very early fall, I had the surgery done, and, you know, the surgery didn't take an hour, it took 4 hours, and I wound up being cut from the bottom of the ribcage down to about the top of where your pubic bone is. So they had to essentially pull my liver out to get behind it. And so the good news is that the mass they removed was benign, so non-cancerous.
That's good.
It was on a ligament that attaches the stomach to the liver. And so they had to do a lot of cutting and tweaking. And so what it wound up being was, at some point in my, probably when I was a firefighter, I probably strained with something way too heavy. So this ligament carries blood vessels and nerves to and from these organs. Mm-hmm. And, he believes when he took it out, they did the pathology, that it was old. I had a bleed, and it had so that's what it was. And it had swollen up. And so, I'm not normally a runner, so the running was
impacting it.
Gotcha. I was having this pain, which is a good thing. It's, you know, you need to get out anyway, because at some point it's going to become infected, or if it ruptured, you'd be in, have a serious infection. So we got it out, but then I spent the next like 6 weeks literally doing nothing. I couldn't even do snake water. Like, I had to have my youngest son make, you know, I was down there with him obviously, but he had to do all the injections. So I was on pretty tight restrictions. And so just not that long ago, I got full clearance. I can, you know, lift heavy things and, you know, run and do whatever I want to again. So good outcome. So that's why we kind of started out last year with this goal of what we're going to do for shows. But we took a hiatus. We had to take a hiatus.
Right. Yeah.
Life that need to be addressed. And you know, Bill's a very understanding guy. There's no pressure from Bill whatsoever, as you can imagine, to get anything done or to anything accomplished. But we do have a show scheduled in April. We're coming back, and we're going to model you guys, where we're just going to hang out and catch up.
Those are the best. There's some people that those are their favorite ones. It's like, all right, yeah. Just listen to me rant.
I don't know why, but yeah, okay. Yeah. But then I listen to you guys, and then I understand why. But, you know, who would want to listen? I'm glad you're doing okay. I can totally relate. Yeah. You know, NPR sucked last year. I lost my mom too, a tragic accident as well, and it's just been headed, you know, problem after problem after problem, and you know, and but I feel like I don't know. This year, I'm trying my best to like just make each episode better than the last one. You know, to try to keep that standard.
He left me in charge of the ship for like 3 weeks. And that was just, horrible. Like, that was, I was terrified.
You got a whole new appreciation for me, huh?
It's a lot of work. Weekly basis, week after week, for what, 12 years now? 13 years?
13 years.
13 years. Yeah.
Right? Week after week, right? I bet you look back first 2 years, you probably thought there's no way we're going to go make it to year 13, right?
We're making it to year two. I kept expecting us to never ever come back, and then it just kept going, and here we are.
It's a lot of work. You guys know that we only do 3 or 4 shows a year, and sometimes Bill and I are like, man, that was a lot of work to pull that show together. It's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that people don't realize. Like, you get a guy lined up, and then they say, I've reconsidered, right? And you're like, now what do we do? Or your idea of what the show should be with this person, they don't want anything to do with it. They want to do something else. The logistics.
Yeah.
Making sure that you're available.
Yeah, especially, you know, that was one of the things we were talking about before we started, but I think that the younger generation of podcasts, you know, I think why you're seeing so many of them is because it's easier than ever to do now. You know, I mean, it's still a lot of work, especially if you want to put out a good show, more or less on the research side of things. And the, you know, then now you have the whole posting to social media thing, and, you know, and editing and making sure that now it's video too. And, you know, it's just crazy. Back then you just called on the phone. You know, you over Skype.
That's video, and you have to have a store, and you have to have all the other things, and then people are going to contact you to want to know if you want to run an ad for Purple Mattress and all that other fun stuff that kind of comes in it. But
But I think like you, buddy, do you have, I'm sure you've had people contact you and thank you for putting out the podcast because the information that you guys provided was, you know, help them breed X species or breed, you know, or keep, you know, a little bit better, or, you know, maybe they weren't having luck with animals, you know, whatever the case would be. I'm sure you've had that. You've had that.
You get people and say, oh, that was a great show. Blah, blah. We want more.
And
people say, oh, we're, you know, we're a huge fan and all this kind of stuff.
So that's cool.
It's all good stuff. And that's not really, but you know, you guys, I know, are the same way. Like, you know, this is not about, for me, it wasn't about like, it's not about fame, or it's not about, you know, present or anything like that. It really was, I want more people to want to take the leap of faith and get into these animals. And, you know, because as we had talked about before, it took me many, you know, I could have bought Mr. Blue. I was vending at the show that Tim had he had condos there. We're right next to each other. I've got my jungle carpet pythons. He's got Mr. Blue. We've got, I don't know if I ever shared the photos, but there's Mr. Blue was on that table. I could have bought it.
Wow.
I could have bought anything. But I was so fearful to take that leap.
Yeah.
I didn't believe in myself that I could do that. I want people to believe that, you know, you can do this. You know, and then there's the flip of the coin too, is that we don't want to make it, we don't want to seem like it's all, you know, it's all cotton candy once you get a condor, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's, sure. Yeah.
Because of what species you keep, there's ups and downs with everything.
And, yeah, for sure.
You know, there's no guarantees that, you know, you're going to be successful, or that you may not have a challenge. You might have a challenge or two. So, you know, I think that really is one of my concerns, is that I think that sometimes we may even say, oh, they're so easy that anyone can do it, but we may not realize it's so easy because we have the experience, and that people don't have the experience. I think it's so easy, so they may struggle a bit before they ask for help.
I do hear that a lot, that once you have chondros dialed in, that they're super easy. And, you know, it reminds me of, we used to say that carpet pythons are bulletproof. And I think Ryan Dumas messaged me and he said, I think you should change that verbiage, because, you know, people may neglect them without even knowing that they're neglecting them, because you're saying that they're so bulletproof that they could, you know, if they don't have this or they don't have that, or if it gets too cold, you know, all of these things that, you know, I don't know. It just really changed my perspective on that and how that comes across, you know, because similar to what you're saying, I want people to feel confident with the snakes they keep, but, you know, not pretend that it's just like you just set them up and forget about it type of deal.
Yeah. There's a learning curve with anything. Right. And we come from an era where, you know, at least I do, and I'm pretty sure you guys do too, or, you know, all this content that's available to people through social media and podcasts and vlogs and websites. We grew up in an era where there were, you know, 5 books.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they contradicted each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of, even though you had some basic information, there was a lot of figuring out on your own. Like my first clutch, my first and only clutch of jungle pythons, you know, that was it. They were so hard for me to establish. But now that, you know, I have all this, I'm like, you know, all this other information where people are like, oh, this is, yeah, they're really tough, but if you do this, they start right away. I'm like, no, I never thought about trying. You know, I didn't know you could do that. So there's a lot
of right. Yeah.
For people that weren't available to us. But I think too, is that you have to have the mindset that it's, you know, it's going to be a challenge no matter what you're working with. It's going to be a challenge. And some people don't want challenges, right? They want the reward, but they don't want the challenges that are going to give them that reward. So, you know, that's I think that's a big disconnect with me and some of the newer keepers that I work with, is, you know, they're thinking, you know, clutches and clutches down the road. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, hold on. You know, you just got, you've got an animal here that's not feeding, you right. know, really solid animal. You need to figure this out first before you start, you know, putting up a website and mm-hmm. buying anything yeah. here. Let's do yeah. step one. Let's get this, you know, figuring out these animals. You know, I bought a very nice female condor years and years ago, and she didn't eat for 13 months.
Jesus.
I was by myself because it was very expensive. And she was an amazing female. And of course, everyone knew that I had posted it on back in the day, back in India. Hey, how's that female mm-hmm. doing? And I was like so fearful to say, well, it hasn't eaten for me. But when she started eating, she was fine. But yeah. it took me to wait it out, right? Mm-hmm. And I accept that challenge that was given to me. And, you know, I placed the blame solely on me. It wasn't the same breeder. Something was wrong and something was amiss, and I wasn't in tune to what it was.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they survived, right?
Yeah. We've preached that before, where it's like, even back in the days of the MP forms, it was, you got a pair of carpet pythons. You spent money on a good looking carpet python. Then you got your business name. Then you got your LLC. Then you got your website. Then you did all this. And then you were going to sell the babies from the first clutch to pay for all the cages that you just bought on credit. Like, it was all that. And it was, you know, and these are the mistakes that I made.
Look at you now.
I did these. Like, this is what I did. So when people are like, what would you do? I'm like, freaking baby steps, man. Like, you know, slowly. Yeah. Like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Just because you grow into it. And there are certain things that we've gotten to the point now that I would have spent a ton of money for, but somehow just end up seem to fall into my lap. Like, if you're in it long enough, you'll get to where and get it into everything. And by being successful with one species makes it easier to transition to another species. Cause then you can, I'm very much in the, I don't like spending money on snakes anymore. I'd much rather find that guy that's got what I want and I have what he wants. And we'll be like, all right, well, I'm just going to send you these Madagascar hognose. Give me these Cebus. Like, yeah, it's like that.
Right.
Yeah, sure. But I think you did a lot. So unfortunately, one of the side effects of social media is people usually only post their successes.
Right.
So
right.
when people have yeah. a challenge, so maybe you bought a handful of animals from a particular species, and you know you've got every one of these animals that come in, and they're all rocking and rolling, and then you get this one animal, and things are different, and you know you need to figure it out. And I see a lot of negativity a lot of times in that, in that aspect, where they're not prepared to figure it out. Like, well, right. what now? Like, so you have to mature and grow and expect challenges with no matter, you know, pythons or whatever species, there's going to be challenges. And you know, you only see the good things doesn't mean there can't be bad things as well.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, when stuff does go wrong, because a lot of people don't post, you can also feel like you're on the island where it's like, clearly I'm the bad keeper and stuff like that, where it's like a lot of this stuff, everybody's had to run in with it somewhere. Like everybody's had to run in with mites. Okay. Like, you know, it's not anything new, but people don't post about it. So if you had it, you might be beating yourself up about it.
And if you do post it, in true honesty, like if you have, you
know, hey, people try to tear you apart.
Oh yeah, people rip you to shreds.
Right.
So yep.
You learn in that environment. Like that's a great learning experience for the person that's having the problem, but also for people who haven't had that problem yet. Like, well, how do you handle it?
Right.
Like, what if it happens? What if it occurs in my collection? What do I do? But all you get is negative feedback or, you know, negative comments. It doesn't help the hobby in any way. It doesn't help people grow.
No.
So
No. Yeah, that's...
I spoke to somebody at a show because I said, because they were talking about getting new snakes and quarantining. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's like, well, I trust you. I shouldn't. I'm like, no. You quarantine everybody. I don't care. Like, no, everyone.
Yeah, I think the thing that people don't realize with that is, like, when the breeder is selling you an animal, you're looking at the behavior and the outward appearance. You don't know if there's something going on inside that animal, or, like, you know, you don't know, you know what I mean? Like, or I don't know. I just think of, like, you just should. It's just best practice that you always best should,
practices,
regardless of who it's coming from.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've made that mistake.
His first chondro clutch, he sent me like 6 or 7 babies.
Mm. Uh-huh.
And Bill was shocked when I said, yeah, they're in quarantine.
Yeah.
I use Preventamite as one of the things that I use, right? So they were on substrate. Been treated before they came in, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was properly used the way you're supposed to. And Bill, I was like, Bill, look, man, I love you and I trust you, but I've never had a mite outbreak in my collection. And the reason why is because I think everything that walks in this store has mites, and I treat it as such.
You should. It's
you're going to be okay. But I agree. Like, you know, but exactly. If you post, oh, I got mites, and you're going to hear, well, you didn't follow proper quarantine, or who was the breeder? They were a piece of crap because they sold you a stick with mite. You know, it's just like
they might not even know. It's it's one of those things of that proper quarantine is like oh, don't you trust me? Of course I do. That's why it's in quarantine, and it's why I allowed it here in the first place. Like you have to, because there's too much stuff that can become a problem. And, you know, we of course know the big things: nido, mites,
right,
crypto, insert horrible thing here, but even just the other stuff where it's just, it's good to know, because maybe it gives us a snake a little bit of a chance to kind of mellow and kind of ease into it. And also injury. I know sometimes snakes get injured and stuff like that in transit, so all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, just stress.
Yeah.
Just the stress of the shipping.
Gavin was telling us that stressing out a snake, it can take several months for it to recover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did studies on that. It was months. It's like, holy
3
shit.
3 months to recover from massive stress.
Absolutely.
And especially if you're dealing with more sensitive species, you know?
Yeah.
You know, let's talk diamond pythons.
Yes.
I can't remember. Like, I remember you getting them. What made you get diamond pythons? Was that something you always wanted to work with? Did you work with them before? Like
diamond pythons, Ellen.
What?
So I've always liked diamond pythons. They were always, like chondros, like one of those things that, you know, if you had diamond pythons, you were like, wow, man, you're really, you know, you must be a great keeper. You have diamond pythons. Right. In your collection. And actually, Owen had gotten diamond pythons way back when.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Remember what happened? Owen and I were having a discussion, and I was like, man, you got to get diamond pythons. I'm telling you, you got to get them. So I got diamond pythons, and then Owen got rid of them.
No, I didn't. They died. I did not get rid of them. I did not do well. And, They unfortunately died, but I've been itching to get back into it since then. But I'm glad you've had success, and there have been several times. Yeah, Eric has diamonds, and he's like, oh, I should breed you some. Just keep waiting.
They take a long time, man.
No, they don't. Buddy's like cranking them out, okay? Like, you're just like...
Yeah, well, he started 5 years before me.
Old now.
They're 10 years old?
Yeah.
Damn. 10 years, yeah.
Two of them are 10, and two of them are 9. No, three of them. One of them's 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Time ago.
Again, it just doesn't feel like it's 10 years ago, but here we are.
No. Yeah. I guess that is. Wow. Okay. I mean, your basement is perfect for diamond pythons. It just seems like that's the perfect spot for them.
I initially kept them in tubs for like the first couple of years, but I had them in like a smaller tub system where I could. The first year I kind of just kept them like, you know, hot spot during the day, but no temps at night. Mm-hmm. So they got the 70, 72, those type of things. And then the second year I moved about where I am now, which is my breezeway. And the temperatures out of here, between like 65 to 55 ambience.
Okay.
That's what I've been doing ever since. So they're in my basement. Like I said, they are in a old style Neodesha slam front cage, which has big, right?
It's great.
Which
is perfect for diamond pythons because I can have a heat source, but it's not going to build up in the cage.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
They, you know, warm up and then move away from the heat source, which is what they usually do. They, you know, they, in the morning they warm up under the heat source and they move away. And then sometimes they come back or close to it. And they also don't hold humidity, a lot of humidity.
Right.
So I thought that, well, you know, old school like that, these are like, you know, going to be good diamond python cages. So that's what I keep my adults in. In October I stopped feeding.
Mm-hmm.
They're still in the basement. And then November, I bring them up here to the breezeway after a month of no feeding. And then they stay out here 3 to 4 months, depending on what's going on, how busy I am or how lazy I am about things. They still get a hot 12-hour hot spot. I use radiant heat panels. Obviously no food during that time. And then I bring them back to the basement. I give them a week or two, and then I start feeding again. And then,
you know, when you start feeding them again, are you feeding them smaller meals more often? Are you feeding them larger meals, or what's your approach there?
Males, medium rats, and I feed my males small rats.
Okay.
So like, and the crazy thing is for the next month, they're going to be treacherous. Because they are in like
everything is food mode. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So like walk through and, you know, I'll hear them hitting the glass on the cage or they're, you know, when I'm walking past, they're like, they're actively, you know, crawling the way I'm moving. Cause you know, they're ready for food. One of my males has bit me in the face twice now.
Man.
You know, I learned a lesson the first time, but it's
only with your face.
When you hold the rat in your teeth.
Oh yeah, it's a neat trick. Watch, guys. Yeah.
They're not that accurate at all times. But the other three are pretty docile for, you know, for what they are, and that's pretty much it. And the babies, what I do is like the first year, I kind of keep them downstairs in the basement. So all my animals tend to hatch in the September month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So they overwinter down in the basement. And then, so the following year is when I bring them up to the, breezeway. Yeah. Python clutch. I try to do maternal incubation and, for 2 weeks and she left.
She bailed.
Really? Oh no. Buddy was always worried about that. I remember you were, why would I let that when I can have the stability in an incubator?
Oh, that's so
she was that her on the eggs?
That's not the one she incubated, though. I took those from her.
Oh, okay.
So when I opened up the cage, I could smell a bad egg smell. So I knew I had a bad egg. So I was like, well, maybe the old clutch is infertile, and that's the way it's going to be. Of course, the clutch is mounted together. And I'm like, where is this bad egg? So I lift the clutch up, and I look, and the bad egg is right in the middle of the clutch.
Oh, no.
So I took you guys know I work in the healthcare system, so I have access to sharps and all that. So I had a blunt tip needle that we draw medication with and a syringe. So I took that and I drew out as much of the contents as I could. And then I took a scalpel and cut away as much of the bad egg as I could. And I put the eggs in the incubator and they all hatched.
Oh, wow.
So, From that period forward, I have not tried maternal incubation.
Nope, John. Tried it. It's over.
I don't blame you.
No, I don't blame him either. No, no. Give me these. Get out of here, you idiot.
Chondros, you know, the eggs seem, you know, they're, of course, I'm biased because, you know, I used to keep and breed jungle pythons and coastals. And they're like, mm-hmm. yeah, man, these are like solid. But then they're like, well, they're no different than a coastal or a jungle carpet. It's just I'm so used to dealing with chondro eggs where, you know, if my clothing doesn't match and I open the incubator, they're going to go bad. So,
right. Right.
Yeah, you know, I've had a couple of eggs that look like on the top of the clutch look like they might be desiccating a bit too much, and I've just taken, you know, damp sphagnum moss and thrown it on top of the mass and forgot about it. And then I come back and I'm like, oh, they hatched. They're all on top of sphagnum moss. So those type of things. So yeah, they look good. They, you know, they all pip and do their own thing. I've never had to pip a diamond python, and so they come out and do their thing. Yeah.
I do have a question as far as like when you're breeding them, right? You start feeding them. Do you wait at all to introduce? When, like, what is your process for introductions?
Yeah, so the first clutch I fed and then introduced. And then Josh Easter had said, no, you should introduce for a little bit and then feed. So I've been doing that ever since. But knock on wood, I haven't had an infertile egg since then. So I don't know if that's the reason. Or if it's just, that's just the way it's been. But that's how I've done it now. Like, I'll wait a couple of weeks. So 2 weeks, I probably don't feed. If I'm good in pair, I pair them, separate feed, put them back together, and then usually I can, by June or so, I've seen ovulation, if I witness it. If I witness it.
Right.
They don't eat. So that's usually an indicator. The females are usually, you know, if you keep them, they're ravenous animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when the females refuse food, I know like something's on the way.
We're on the way. Yeah.
Really shed.
Yeah, because they'll eat in the wintertime. You know, like they you know.
They will eat
dairy. Sorry, you're
So I don't do anything special for, you know, I just leave the female and the egg in the enclosure. And she picks a spot and lays the eggs, and I just take them from her.
Pretty straight ahead.
Yeah,
it's very straightforward. It's just like, you know, like I said, I'm very biased because I've been keeping green tree pythons for so long, and you know, I forget about these distant memories. Like, oh yeah, this is, you know, when you breed chondros specifically or generally. You do these extra things that you don't have to do. I don't feel you have to do for these other snake species. Like, you know, I got to put chondro in a small little 6-quart tub in a rack. She can lay her eggs instead of spreading them out all over the cage. Right. With the pythons, I have just left them in there and they lay their eggs. Though I will say my one female, her first year, she laid 6 or 7 eggs. And I thought it was kind of odd. It's like, that's a small clutch. And then, you know, I took the clutch away from her, but I palpated her. I could feel there was more eggs there. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, so I put the female back in her cage and I gave her a couple more days away. And so I made an appointment to see my reptile vet. And he's like, retained eggs. I had a chondro a few years back that had retained eggs. And, you know, he had done surgery and got the eggs out and the snake never recovered. So he's like, I don't know. He's like, I don't know if surgery's going to be worth it or not. He's like, I would say, let's just wait. He's like, she seems fine. He's like, feed her and see what happens. So I fed her. Mm-hmm. And then she defecated and there would be an egg in the enclosure. And so,
oh, wow.
Within like 3 or 4 months, she passed them all.
And oh, wow. Made it
with 0 problems.
That's so weird.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It worked out that way, but that's so weird.
I had a good vet. He has since retired. I'm very sad about that. But, you know, his advice was like, let's just take it and wait and see. You know, I don't think we need to rush into doing surgery. Let's kind of see what's going on. She's acting normal.
Yeah. You
know, so great advice. It worked out.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, we're headed to Sydney in October. I'm hoping that I can get hands on a real live wild diamond python. Apparently, they're all over the place there. So, Yeah, fingers are crossed.
The social media thing. There's one of the guys from Australia. He goes kicking your cat, but he has a whole thing with just diamond pythons that he's caught at people's houses and.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
in flower beds. It's really great. Yeah.
If you want to learn about carpet pythons, they are definitely one that you can follow all the snake catchers in Australia, and you can learn all about different, you know, localities and stuff like that for sure. I think I follow more state snake catchers than I do breeders. it's good stuff.
Pretty cool. But they're, you know, I won't say they're bulletproof, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So compared to chondros, they're very robust and hardy.
Yeah.
My first clutch, I had trouble getting the babies established.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
So I was using, you know, thaw tanks. Mm-hmm. That didn't work. And so I reached out to Josh Easter, and he recommended that I set them up like a baby chondro with a perch. Mm-hmm. And I have hopper mice. And I'm like, are you sure they can eat hoppers? And he's like, I'm positive. You want hoppers because the motion is what kind of gets them going.
Yeah.
And anyway, I went out and got hoppers, and I think every snake but one ate that day, and within like a week or two, the other one had eaten. And last year I hatched out two clutches, and 28 of the 32 ate on the first try with five hoppers.
They're like bread light. Hoppers.
Yes.
Bread light do the same thing. They're like nervous around
frozen
fuzzies. Yeah.
Their go-to food in the wild would be skinks and stuff like that. And that fast movement. Maybe that just like, you know, it just triggers them to go after it.
It's interesting to watch. I'll sit there and watch, you know, and I like to watch snakes eat, you know, I think most of them, right? But it's interesting to watch. Like, some of them will immediately grab. And this year I haven't offered perches other than the four that were challenging to get started, but I haven't offered, but you can see some of them, like you'll see the hopper like scurry across the front of the tub, and you'll see the snake following it. So it's to definitely tell the snake's interested. Some of them grab right away, but some of them do this like follow things where they follow. At least in my
still trying to figure out what the hell it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're moving right, but you don't smell right.
And then, you know, they come back usually and they're gone. Then, you know, they have this huge, and I'm like, oh my God, please don't let them regurge. I try to handpick the smallest hoppers I can find.
Yeah.
Big meals. I mean, you know, they're you know, the size of like a jungle carpet python baby, maybe a little bit bigger. They look more close to a coastal. So they're, you know, robust babies. They're all chill. Once they get beaten, change your attitude. Like now they're at the point where like I go change water and they, you know, spring out of their hide and latch onto my hand.
That's what these are slowly becoming. That the roughies, they were chill, and now they're all of a sudden starting to get really, they started figuring out that the sound of the latch makes when I open it means that I'm usually coming in for food. So yeah,
that's cool. With the babies, as far as temperatures go, how do you just set them up with, what is it, just in a rack with heat tape type of deal? Like what's your approach there?
Just like my chondros, a 6-quart tub.
Okay.
Initially in the first couple of clutches, I put perches in just because Josh thought that like them, because they definitely will perch, and even as adults they do perch, so they're definitely provide them with enclosure with, you know, some vertical space. They'd probably definitely take advantage of it for sure. They like to climb, they like to perch, but the babies perch like baby chondros, and what Jack kind of thought was like they definitely hang their head down just like a chondro does, so having that cross underneath of them too. But this past year I didn't do any perches, newspaper substrate. I use cut up paper towel rolls as high, so you know that way I can throw stuff away. I'm not real keen on having to, you know, scrub plastic high boxes, especially with and like a little, you know, 6-quart water dish, and I have a warm spot set at like 86, and that's all 12 hours, and then at night they get the ambient temperature of the degrees. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, this is my My females never leave their perches. Then never. They're always off the ground. I never see them on the ground.
That might be a sign that stuff's happening. Like my roughy females are on the ground right now. And normally they're in the ceiling hides or on the bins. And now they're making divots in the mulch. So
yeah,
that may be a sign.
That'd be a good thing.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Need more babies.
You need more roughy babies?
They always need more roughy babies.
Roughy babies. Okay, fair enough. Yeah. I guess, should we hit on the Patreon question, I guess, Owen? So the Patreon question for this month is, how do you give back to the hobby? Which is probably an easy one for you.
Yeah, he's got a podcast.
I am a member of USR. Definitely do that. And really, that was my big push for why we did GTP Keeper Radio as a podcast. I thought that would be a way to give back to everyone that helped me, because when I was learning things, a lot of people helped me along the way. And were patient and took the time to explain things to me. And so, hopefully Bill and I are doing the same thing when we do the podcast.
Yes. Yeah.
Very cool.
It was kind of a, when the people put that question, I was like, oh, well, that's kind of an easy question. I
mean, really easy for Buddy. Yeah.
For us, you know. But cool. I don't know. What else you got, Owen?
Something like that.
What was that?
Yeah. You got anything else?
I said you're conjuring. Yeah. Some question. I'm not prepared for that.
No.
I mean, they can't help.
Which is better, red or yellow? Supposedly, yeah. That's a big
Which
thing
would in you the prefer? Conjuring world. Tell right us now.
Which I don't know why. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I like both. Like, I understand the appeal of the high-end designer stuff.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Visually, right?
They're beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's 100%.
Well, I think regular green pythons are gorgeous, too. And I think that, most people start down the pathway of green tree pythons. They're exposed to the normal greens usually, right? Yeah. I got them because they were green initially, right? I want a green snake. I still have some higher end designer stuff in my looking stuff in my collection, but most of my animals are still green. But that's just, it's personal preference. There's a lot of, I know. There's a lot of stuff on social media, like in the past 3 months, about red versus yellows and blah, back and forth. And some of it is fun. And because it's always been a thing, even when we had the Morelia Virtus forum, that was always which one's better, blah, blah, blah. It was kind of a joking thing, but I think really with the context is missed on social media is some people really take it seriously.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Way
seriously. Like to the part where there's name calling and, people pointing out, why they think other people are, because they breed a certain, because they like a certain color of neonate or a downfall of the hobby and all, it's like, that's a little over the top. Itself, right? And sometimes it even I am not really, I'm not a lot of Instagrams where I do most of my snake stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Even though I moderate Morelia Virtus Forum Facebook, I might go on there once a day. And it's only because there's something's been reported to me as content. So I don't really read everything and
stuff
like that. So, I'm not in tune on the social media side of green tree pythons like I used to be. I got alerted, there was something that was, didn't meet Facebook standards and, I had to go review it and all this stuff. And so it was a discussion about, of course it was about the red, your friend versus yellow. So, but my takeaway from that whole little thread there was, you know, my 10,000 foot view is jealousy.
Yep.
In this instance, a lot of it was driven by pure jealousy. So, which you have to ask yourself, and I know you guys have asked, you have to ask anybody who stakes for a long enough time, why do you do what you do?
Right.
Behind it. Like, if the why is you're keeping green tree pythons to make, you know, Buddy Buscemi happy, you're keeping it for the wrong reasons. Or if you're only keeping, you know, if I come out and say, I only keep red neonates, and you say, well, I'm only keeping red neonates because that's all Buddy Buscemi kept. Well, that's not the right reason to do anything.
Right.
You know, you need to, when you guys know this, when things go bad, mm-hmm. right? With that gut punch, you're going to know mm-hmm. how into these animals you are.
Yeah.
Right. And trust me, yeah. I've had some pretty hard gut punches and I'm still around doing it. So you have to really keep the animals because they're the ones you want to keep and you like it the way they are. You don't have to, and you can, it's okay to say mine are the best because I made them. And that's mm-hmm.
right.
I love yellow neonates or I love red neonates and they're the best. And that's completely fine. But when you go down the road of name calling or trying to point out others' wrongdoings to try to make yourself look better, or you're going down the wrong road and you're making not the impression that you should be making. So my whole takeaway from that whole thing, red versus yellow thing, is, you know, do your thing, but, you know, do it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. It's funny you say that. Like I reflect on this sometimes. It's like, you know, when you're dealing with a niche part of the hobby, like say Morelia, right? Yeah, it's popular to us. But when you look at the grand scheme of the hobby, maybe it's more popular now, but even going back to when we started NPR. And I guess when you're a show and you see the ball python people just, you know, everybody spending money with them and, you know, everything is good. And they're the people that are pointed out. It's sort of like we started to... I don't know, sort of like carpets are better and ball pythons suck. And, you know, like all this talk. And it's like, what I've learned is it's like, why do you have to knock something down in order to build yourself up? Just build yourself mm-hmm. up on what you got. You know, I think really ultimately the thing that I've learned is that, you know, for me, that's carpet pythons. And I'm so happy that I finally just embraced that because I got people all around the world sending me pictures of carpet pythons all the time, which is the greatest thing ever. You know, people from Australia just like, hey, mate, I saw this in my yard. Hey, mate, I was out herping and I checked this out. And it's like, oh, that's so cool. You know, it's like I've sort of just embracing sort of what you're saying, rather than knocking down something else and being negative about something else in the hobby. Lord knows we have to be together. Just because I don't particularly like the species that you keep doesn't mean that I have to shit on it in order to make mine better. Just mm-hmm. let mine be better. Like, it's better to me. I don't care what you think of it.
Just let the carpet python be better than everyone else's. That's what I'm saying. Thank God you finally said it, Eric. Just let the carpet python be better.
And maybe it's because we've been doing this for so long. I don't know. Or it's just because I'm getting old. But I just feel like, I don't know. I don't understand. There needs to be less negativity. And to your point, people just take it too serious to where it's like, oh, I like jungle carpets. And it's like, fucking jungle carpets suck. Blah, 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 blah. And it's just like,
they do. They're horrible. Oh,
I don't know. That's sort of my thinking along that lines. But. Yeah, I just thought it was funny with the red and yellow thing. And
yeah, do what you love to do. I mean, really, that's what it's all matters. If you love it, whatever color neonate you think is the best, I'm not going to argue with you.
Yeah.
But don't
think
it's the best because somebody else told you, or because you think it's the popular thing. Like if it's, you know, you've all seen this. We've seen this, like fads. Like fads are just letting other people influence popularity of something that you maybe are only not even interested in, but it's a temporary burst in popularity. And it's based upon what other people, you know, think is the cool thing, in thing, that type of stuff. So it's like that. So we had talked about how I started to show how we had been to the show. We did this. So we were there a couple weekends ago, the show in Frederick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Larry runs it. So, you know, it really is more of an opportunity for five of us that have been friends for a long time to kind of get together and catch up, and you know, who cares whether we actually saw a snake or not. But I had a couple of my diamond pythons on the table, and a young man come over and was talking to me, and we were just, you know, chatting and all this stuff. And I have diamond jungle jacks. I was like, oh, they're pretty amazing animals. Yeah. So, got any pictures of them? Like, yeah. So, they're pretty, you know how they are. They're pretty amazing. Can be very looking animals, right? He's like, yeah, but I kind of feel guilty about having them. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, he's like, I was listening to a podcast, and there was a really influential carpet python breeder who was not talking very highly about, you know, diamond jungle jacks. And I'm like, so? Right. Like, what do you mean? I was like, are you keeping them to make that person?
They're yours. Who gives a shit? It's just, yeah.
You like them and you love them. And he goes, I love them. I was like, then that's all that matters. Who cares?
Yeah.
Keep if that's what you love, then you do what you love, right? And
I bet you I know who that carpet python breeder was.
I have a good idea, yeah.
Well, you know, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing too. It's like this is another eye-opening experience I had when I was listening to Chuck and Justin talk on Reptile Fight Club, and they were talking about, you know, like mixed carpets. And it's funny how, like, you know, I just think of, like, look pretty, but for whatever reason you put on this word and it makes them sort of less than, right? But like, again, taking a note from the chondro community, you guys put a word like designer on it, and it makes it feel better. You know what I mean? It's like a positive thing for something that we're looking at a negative thing. You know, I mean,
right.
I don't know. And well, whoever that person was, right? The thing of it is like we were talking about this yesterday, and you know, the stuff we have in the States, we don't know if that stuff.
No, I'm freaking idea.
Sorry, man. Yeah. I'm sorry. I mean, I hope that it is, and I'm going to embrace it like it is. But like, remember Cypress Creek diamonds, right? Turns out that they're related to Riverbank Zoo and San Diego Zoo and all the lines that are supposedly supposed to be the purest of the pure. And the Cypress Creek was getting shit. And now all of a sudden, through DNA testing, they find out that it's not. So like... Mm-hmm. But it still looked like a diamond python and acted like a diamond python. I don't know. I don't get that, but I do. And I don't, I understand the idea of like wanting to have, you know, if you're really into like locality animals or something like that. Right. I get that. Yeah. But I don't know.
Eric, I'm sorry. I missed the last part. You froze up on me.
Oh, I was saying about, locality, like I understand why people would want to keep stuff like pure if they're into like localities and stuff like that. But even if you're into localities, how do you even prove that, especially with some of the species, especially with Australian stuff, you can't prove that that came from this locality or that locality. You're just going by somebody's word, and that's fine. But why is one person's word better than another person's word? And Owen, I think you sort of brought that up the other night. It's like, why do we believe this story? But this story is just too far-fetched.
That's the bridge too far? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
So what was the DNA stuff about you were saying about Riverbank Zoo? I kind of missed that part.
So Cypress Creek animals have long been dubbed as a mutt in the diamond python world, and people didn't want to touch them. And I've seen battles about these things, right? Like straight up
down, drag out.
Fight. Yep. And turns out that they're all related. So they're just as pure as Riverbank, San Diego, you know.
Well, and somebody brought up a good point where it's like way back when we knew how the diamonds were getting into the country and they came from one guy. And it's like, and yes, of course, some of them were in the San Diego Zoo and all that, but he only had a certain number of diamonds. So to say that this is a different line than this, when you trace back to one dude and his three diamonds, it's like, I don't really know where the differences are, but
I've heard a lot of interesting stuff about the Cypress Creek and the Geb Bailey stuff. And it's just, you know, if you think about it, when these animals were coming in, like one of the things I was kind of amiss when I was researching, diamond pythons before I purchased them was like, well, do you have a lineage? Well, no, it's, I can tell you. So like the one animal I bought, they're like, oh, I got it from this person. So I called that person and said, hey, did you produce animals from these type of animals? And did you sell one? Oh yeah, I did. I'm like, okay. So that sounds pretty legit to me. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the person actually had, two. So I have four adult animals, from three different sources.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I bought, the one I'm buying the pair from, he had lineage stuff, but didn't have it in a lineage chart. So I put it in a lineage chart for him.
Okay.
Right? Oh, okay.
And so, but anyway, just talking to a couple people about, especially like the Cypress Creek and the Creek stuff and the Get Bailey, you know, mm-hmm. some speculation was that they may have been imported illegally and people weren't going to put
yes.
a lineage on an illegally imported animal, because then they can be traced back to them in that way, because, you know, how long yep. is it if you go down that route, right?
You have to get far enough away from it, then we'll all start admitting that they're diamonds. Oh, okay. Yes. Now the statute of limitations is up, we can all talk about this.
Right. So, yeah. Very interesting conversations. I was on the pathway of this, and essentially my great takeaway was, If you know who produced them and you can trust that people, then I would say chances are they're going to be pure diamond pythons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. And so I've got animals here from San Diego Zoo, Riverbank Zoo, which are Gary Vale, lineage animals. But also there's an import male in his lineage. And I'm like, where'd that import male come from?
Right.
Casey Lindsay animals in there too, right?
Yeah, right.
Long time. I mean, I can't remember if that was one of the species he got in a little bit of trouble for, but yeah. So, and then, you know, then you see names like Josh Easter and Dave Sutton and those type of guys. So you just, you mm-hmm. know, I made sure that they were like people that, and one of those I was able to get a hold of and talk to about like, hey, what's the deal with these animals that people saying aren't, you know, aren't pure, or they're a mysterious,
you know, right.
And into, they're not a bloodline or lineage. They just happen to be animals that were just named from a different lineage, which is right. the other thing too. Well, they're the same animals. They just changed the name of them. And so that way they could have their own name on certain things. We're like, okay, well that really makes things muddy and confusing for everybody.
Yes. So, seems like there is a lot of shady people in the carpet python world in the early days. This is a jungle. This is a diamond.
Yep.
This is a high contrast Queensland carpet python. Just making up names now.
My children I found were supposedly red desert phase children. I wish there is no such thing.
Yeah, no.
They
went.
They came from Utah.
Every other children I've ever looked at was more red or
right. anything else.
But that was the thing with carpet pythons. It was what was it? One of my first jags was a red hypo jag. He was neither red nor hypo. He was a jag, so that there, I guess one in the mix works. But that was the name they threw at it because it was just a fun red jaguar, and you got to try to throw enough jello at the wall to make it interesting.
I think similar to the chondro thing, it's like you had what you had. You worked with what you worked with. When crazy things popped out, you didn't know what to call it. Mm-hmm. You probably just made a name up because this is what it looked like at the time. And then that name stuck because, you know, you put it on a form or something. Then just, you know, although in what you're talking about, Owen, remember the banana jags and the other jags, all these crazy Spider jags. So it's yep. like, oh, man. I don't know. Anything else you guys want to hit on? Well, go ahead, buddy. Go ahead. Sorry.
How's the hippopotamus gene?
I'm working on it. I got distracted with like. I got distracted with other things. I have to start like compiling carpet things again. So yeah.
Wait, what was the thing you sent me the other day? If we got the battle chondro, it was a rough scale and a green tree.
Right.
And then you,
I said, you, what did I call it? I called it something like the psychopath. Because I have I have Wamina scrubs again because I've decided to do that. And I'm like, I wonder what would happen if you bred a Wamina to a Ruffy. If I was crazier, a little bit crazier than I am now, I would do this. And I forget the name I gave it, but it was something horrible. So yeah,
that was really good. Damn it. Yep. I thought you would have had that.
I'll try to find it. I think I sent it to you and Lucas, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know which chat it was in. All right. Where can listeners follow? You said Instagram is your place where you're posting up snakes. GTP Keeper, right?
I use Morph Market to.
Okay. Yeah, it's your diamond on there. Fair enough.
You say I may or may not have been looking at your diamonds recently on there. So, you know, may or may not.
Well, you just have to, you know, reach out. You might have something. I might, you know, how you like to. Take this for that.
Yeah, I'm out of green tree pythons. So, yeah. We'll think of something. Yeah.
Very cool. All right.
Are you breeding this year? Are you pairing stuff up? What's going on with your collection?
With my stuff, I had a huge year last year. So, I am stepping back. I'm trying to get another clutch of white lips. Because that was 2 years ago. And then I have a hypo tiger project. And then I'm not doing anything else carpet python. But I have my Chinese king rats together. I have two pairs of rhino rat snakes together. And then I'm not doing olive pythons again because I still have olives. Like I am drowning in baby olive pythons. So, but I am going to put the Ruffies together. I'm just giving them a little bit of a shot. They were together and then they're separate now for feeding and then they go back together. But both females are like just still pounding food right now. So I have no idea what's going on. But they ate all the way through last year too. The one female, I didn't even know she was gravid. I just hadn't seen her in a while. And then I found her around eggs and I'm like, well, all right, there you are. So yeah.
Are they spring breeders traditionally in the fall or winter?
I had one clutch in June and then I had the other clutch in like September. So like, I'm like, this doesn't make any goddamn sense. Like you guys are all over the map. So I don't know. I think it's just also because they only have one boy that's big enough. So it might have been that he was with the one girl at the right time. And then by the time he got to the other girl, it was later, but she still ovulated. So yeah.
Nice. So those olive pythons, you still have the animal that tried to eat me times too?
I believe so. Yes.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah, he's still here.
Is that a carpet fest?
Favorite olive python.
I'm sorry. You broke up there, buddy. What was that?
Just so you know, because they're from that animal, I'm not interested in any.
Okay. No. Nope. I'm not. Any other olive? I have two pairs of olives, so I'll just make sure that one's not included. So, yeah.
They'll eat anything.
Oh, yeah. At this point, I'm getting Savus at the end of the month, and then I will have all the Liasis. I will rule. So.
You have Shonai?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah. They're like a Maclots, but not. So it's like
less freckles, right?
Less freckly Maclots python. You know, I mean, they'll still eat everything in sight. Mine like the musk on me, which I kind of hate. But they're just like that. A little less psychotic. I have some Max from Mike Curtin. That are just the spawns of Satan. And it's just like, you're so small. Why are you such a-holes? And it's like, yeah, but whatever. Yeah. But yeah, no, I like the Dunai. They're cool.
Let's check those out. If you ever get some of those, I might be interested in if you ever make any of those available.
They may or may not be together right now. Like it's.
What I liked about my Maclots pythons was, you know, they fed like that.
Yep.
Like, you know. No, never a problem, Peter.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So the rat there be done. It didn't matter. Like it could be a rat pink or a fuzzy mouth. It didn't.
They're eating it.
They're down like no problem.
I, I am so annoyed that I keep climbing up the Macklots hill and then something keeps knocking me back down to the bottom. Like, I got a female all the way up and she died egg bound. And then I got a female all the way up and she had cancer. I got a female all the way up, turned about to be a boy. I have claimed scorched earth on Macklots Python. I have two males. And then I think I have one, two, three, I have four females. Okay. Scorched earth. I'm going to get a clutch of Macklots Pythons in the next couple of years if it kills me. So done. But yeah,
they're good. I mean, they're big. The eggs are big. They're, you know, babies are big and robust.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got white lips before I got Macklots Pythons. It doesn't make any goddamn sense. Like, it's, yep.
Yeah, you got white lips before Popwin carpets.
Don't want to talk about that. We're not talking about that. That is not important. Okay.
And I
said I would fix that too. I have a pair of Het Granites that I swear to God, once the eggs are laid, putting them in a t-shirt cannon and launching them at your house. Like, it is, get these things out of here. I'm going to check
you
the
just
box.
Have enough.
Then they're gone.
Right.
Damn. God damn.
Eric, and your diamond pythons, what are you breeding them this year, or are they not ready yet? Or?
I just brought them up. I have a Riverbank Zoo female and I have a reduced pattern female that I'm breeding with a San Diego Zoo male. That's what I got.
So. Gotcha. Are you doing any of the stardust or reduced pattern animals, or are they normal looking diamond pythons?
Well, the one female is a reduced pattern, and then I have a male reduced pattern that he's got a few years to go, but my hope is maybe I could try to figure out the whole how does the reduced pattern work type of deal. So we'll see. Yeah, I think I'm gonna have to breed it. What's that?
That works. Allegedly one of my females is a reduced pattern animal. I'm not sure how that works.
She might have been.
I don't think anybody knows how it works. I think it's recessive, to be honest. It's popped up in every single. Well, that's another reason why, in my opinion, those bloodlines are all the same, because they popped up in almost every. It's popped up in the Riverbank Zoo one I have is supposedly a reduced pattern. If you look at her, I guess you could say it, but it doesn't look like the ones that I got from. What the hell's his name? Oh man, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. Dave Heim. No, Greg Heim. Yeah. So my reduced pattern stuff comes from him. And that's all San Diego Zoo and Gary Valle stuff.
Yeah.
Hopefully I can do it. I'm kind of nervous because I haven't bred in 2 years. So it's kind of like, I don't know why I'm nervous about it, but it's like, I don't know what to do.
I'm glad Buddy's here with me. Take the eggs and put them in the incubator. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I only made that mistake once. Come on, man.
Just saying.
I will probably try one clutch being maternally incubated.
Well, what time do you go to work? And will Dory let me in? Because
I'm sure she will.
Yeah. She's like, where are the eggs? Oh, they're in the incubator where they're supposed to be.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
I've had really good luck with
maternal
incubation.
You know what?
I've had
when you have the number of diamond python eggs and clutches that Buddy has, then you can start fucking around, okay? Put them in the incubator. Okay.
Right. Okay, Owen, for you, I'll put them in the incubator. That's not all you ask. You're going to ask for 2.2 diamond pythons.
It's fine. Shut up. It's fine. Fine. Got roughies. You're fine.
Yeah. We did trade a hypo for a.
It finally happened. That trade finally went through.
One way or the other, that was going to happen. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. Next year, I'm going to try to tick. I should have a. I know I've been trying this for years, but. Sort of like you, I've been gut punched many times. And I hope next year I'm going to try to breed every type of carpet python.
Oh, nice.
That's my goal next year. So Brettles, Darwins, Jungles, Inlands, Diamonds, Cape Yorks, Poplins. I think that's it.
That is, of course, unless they change the taxonomy on him again, and then I'm not sure again, if he has to add,
then I'll be screwed.
Or subtract, or add, yeah, it doesn't, I don't know. It might be one of those weird things, so.
Yeah.
But, so. Yeah.
We'll see.
And then we promise that we have a tentative idea of when Carpet Fest will be this year. But, you know, once we hammer that out, we will let you know, because I know you want to try to make it. Bill showed up at the last one. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah,
you need a buddy to balance a bill.
Yeah, he's a lot without you. So it's,
yeah, I was disappointed. Like I said, we moved my son to into college, and of course, awesome. We could, great, so we could cover Fest. Well, yep. I tried to go to college, we get him to change a date, but they weren't having it.
I think this was my favorite Carpet Fest. If I'm being honest, I don't know if it's just because we haven't had one in a while.
And because I locked you out of your own snake room. Yeah.
Well, that's probably for me the biggest thing, is because I actually got to interact with people and stuff instead of like showing them my snakes in 85 degree weather for 12 hours.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah.
Yeah. I missed it. Hopefully maybe this year I can make the return if it happens.
It's going to happen. It'll happen. We'll get there. We'll figure it out, and we'll let everybody know as soon as possible. So,
yeah.
Great memories, not only talking to snake people, but for me, hanging around the campfire pit.
Oh, yeah. With
Delon and Nick and Max Curtin. Yeah. I mean, both have a company because you have to hang around a campfire with.
Yeah.
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 Those are where you have some really good conversations, too. You know, it's like you don't have to worry about, you just sort of have the conversation. So.
Damn curtain children are getting bigger in front of me too. Like, on top of these people's kids growing, it's really annoying.
We're getting older, Owen.
Yeah, it's not. I'm not all right with this. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
I'm good. If there's anything else you want to toss out there, buddy, just toss it out. And if you're looking for good, really, really good looking diamonds, I'm not allowed to look at Morph Market anymore now. So I'm just going to put that over here. So, just go on to Morph Market GPT Beekeeper on there. And if you're also looking for a chondro, so you can hit Buddy up. He's kind of one of those guys that I think if you're starting to get into it, he definitely helped me when I had my chondros and when I was playing with that experiment. And I know he's helped people in the past. So he wouldn't just kind of, oh, you would a Neo and be like, good, bye, here you go. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
But awesome. I guess that's it. All we have. Thanks again for coming on, buddy. You get the, hopefully it won't be such a large gap in between. So,
yeah. Looking forward to hearing GTP Keeper Radio.
Yeah.
Come back. So,
awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're still absolutely.
Podcast. Hands down.
What's that?
You're still my favorite reptile podcast.
Good. All right. Thank you. Good. Good.
I notice a lot of reptile podcasts like to get sucked into drama. I just like to talk about snakes. I don't know. You know,
enough drama. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, keep whatever.
There's I think 3 or 4 condor specific podcasts now too. It's a very crowded space.
Jeez.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I stick with carpets. There's only one on carpets. Nobody else wants to talk about them.
You can't. No one wants to talk to them, and you can't kill the kings. So yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
However you want to say it. All right. Okay. Next week, we're talking about diamond pythons or student of the serpent type of deal. We're going to go through it just like we went through the caramels. Owen,
nice.
Like that kind of breakdown, me and you, the bloodlines, natural history, all that stuff, you know.
This will be after my whirlwind tour of just podcasts all week this week, man.
yeah, you better. Yeah. What do you got? What do you have?
I have Colubrid and Colubroid Radio tomorrow, and then I'm doing a live stream on Sunday. So it's like, and then of course, all that. You and I recorded yesterday. So it's just.
Yes.
You know, I'm doing a lot of standing in between sitting at this desk. So that's it. That's all we have for everybody tonight. We'll say thanks for listening, and we'll catch everybody back here next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.